kedai, the shir, just to become a little focused on our door. I'm a little less focused than usual, because in yeshiva, they usually have a huge chagiga on Rosh Chodesh Adar. But our yeshiva is an aveda, so one of its talmidim that died is within Shleishim, so we didn't have a chagiga. So my head is not really tuned in yet to Adar, in all honesty. Yeah. The Ikar Purim. Purim is the one chag which ultimately celebrates Klal Yisrael in the Golos. Mitzrayim is redemption from Golos. Purim, as the Gemara says in Megillah, Akati Avdi Achashverosh. We can't say Hallel according to one view in the Gemara, because we were still subject to the Persian Empire. The Yeshua didn't come. So it's the one yontif that was celebrating, not allowed Masa Kodesh, in the Golos. I mean, the survival of Klal Yisrael in Golos, survival, that's the Yisrael that we're celebrating. From that standpoint, it's important to consider that a Yid should never despair. That which we see around us, reality, is often not reality. As real as it is, as concrete as it is, it's all over the newspapers, but it's not real. It's a perspective that in that regard is easier to imagine. If a year ago we spoke about Citigroup, it's the biggest bank in the world, you know, it's Shayach, you know, bigger and more, AIG, the biggest insurance company, at the heart of the whole world financial system. And what do we look at now? Two organizations that are not much different than the guys in the street that play the three-card Monte. That's the reality. Scams on top of scams on top of scams, pipe dreams. And it all works as long as things keep going. But when things are not yomim in the conventional sense, then you see what's there. And ultimately we see there's nothing there. Sort of like Humpty Dumpty, the child of all the king's men, could paste them back together again, you know. That's, you know. And the problem is the joke may be on all of us, but, you know. But so we see that reality, powerful entities, world class powerful entities. And what are they? They're a shell. There's nothing there. There was the reality. It was merely a perception that we had. But the reality, if we understood what they were holding in their portfolio, there was nothing there. So it's easier to see that what we see as reality is not reality. And that's really the whole financial crisis, is because our perception of what we perceive to be real is painfully obvious as unreal. That's the whole problem. If we knew all along we were in this situation where we are today, so nobody would be unnerved by it. If this was the way it always was, no one would be unnerved. If we didn't have more wealth than we have now, the world would go on. And the whole problem is that we thought we were here, and now all of a sudden we're here, and we don't know, are we here? I mean, we're another 20% lower than we are. We just don't know, we don't know what the reality is. The Yisoid of the Megillah is this Yisoid. That our reality, the British Islam's reality, are very, very different. Much more Haman's most triumphant moment in the entire Megillah. So it's clear. Yedavdi comes back from the Mishnah, the first Mishnah that Esther made for him. He's Hameach for Tov Lev. And he has this one problem left. Imagine a man that wields such power. I mean, it's a huge empire. Covers about half the earth at that point. It says Chazal tell us initially it was twice as large. It now had 240 medinas. Now it only has 127 medinas. Half of the, no more than half of the known world is controlled by this empire. This is the prime minister of half of the known world. Imagine there would be a prime minister today that ruled over 3 billion people. And what bothers him? This Mordechai guy, it's on his nerves. The wealth, the power that you have over half the world's people. But he feels so triumphant that anything that annoys him, now he's going to settle the scores. Mordechai? He convenes a meeting, how we're going to take care of Mordechai. So this is his triumphant moment, the moment that he feels. What does he tell them at the meeting after the first Mishnah? Today I was the only one. It's not only I'm a political hack, but I'm tight, super tight with the king and queen. There's nobody else in the entire kingdom that's invited to this tete-a-tete which just took place. V'gam nevocha ani kor Elohim ha-melech. I'm riding high. On the other hand, what was the moment of the greatest despair for Klal Yisrael? So Chazal tells us, was the first Mishnah. Why? There were those Jews, apparently, who knew who Esther was. And they knew she was one of their brethren. And therefore, they harbored the hope that Haman's designs are not going to come into effect. Because the queen is in the palace. So she's not going to let this take place. We're protected. Ultimately, she's going to undo Haman's plans. So Chazal tells us, what was her intention in inviting Haman? So the Gemara in Megillah gives us 6 different reasons why she invited him. And it says that the Amora met Eliyahu HaNovi, and Eliyahu HaNovi told him in Shemayim, they say that all 6 reasons were true. She had 6 different scenarios how this could conceivably help the situation. And she rolled the dice basically on 6 in one shot. One of the scenarios is that Klal Yisrael should not say Achas Lono Beis HaMelech. There's a Jewish queen, she's going to save us. Why? Because she wanted them to be mispalable of Shalom to the Rebbeinu Shalom. As long as we feel a dependency on the possibility of salvation by a human being, then we don't fully put ourselves in the Rebbeinu Shalom's hands. And she saw the only method to bring about the Yeshua was they should put themselves fully in the hands of the Rebbeinu Shalom. So she created intentionally a despair among the Jewish people that there is no earthly means by which they can be saved. Only the heavens itself can possibly provide for their salvation. So the despair that they knew at this moment was beyond belief. So this is the zenith for Haman and the nadir for Klal Yisrael. And what was the reality? That's the perception. Shushan times, the day after the first Tzuda, right? If you, what happens? The morning papers in Shushan, right? Haman has, comes to a secret rendezvous with the king and queen, to an unknown agenda, scheduled to meet with them again tomorrow to continue the meetings. And the Jews are in mourning. News in the Shushan Times, the day after the first Tzuda. And what's the reality of that moment? The reality of that moment is exactly the opposite. Haman was in the trap already. The jaws of the trap were slamming closed around him. And he was so lulled, he had no sense that it was taking place. He came with anticipation. He was waiting for the second Tzuda to take place. The jaws of the trap were about to slam closed on him, and he was totally lulled. So the reality is, the moment, the triumph that he felt when he came home from the first Suda, this is what dulled the sensitivity. He didn't realize that he was being set up for the hitman. Totally lulled. Achieved complete surprise. For the first and for Klal Yisrael, the tefillah which ascended the heavens on that day was boundless. And that's the sight of Yeshua of Klal Yisrael. the reality that we observed and experienced in retrospect is a shell. The entire perception of that day's events as they were understood in real time was fallacious. But he told me a very interesting drush pshat this week. I believe it's an old famous word, if I remember correctly. Parshas Kisisa says, "V'ro'isa sacharai, fonai lo yiro." So he said, the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says that as we go through life, we're troubled by all types of situations, how they're going to get resolved, how we're going to get through them, how this is going to happen. We don't know. What happens is life goes on. When we look back, somehow all of those problems, we manage to come out the other side of them. Well, most of the things which loomed large in life as difficulties, we manage to get through. And we see the Yeshua that we had, the Hashkocha, and the Rebbeinu Shel Olam led us through the problem. He says, "V'ro'isa sacharai." When we look back, then we see the hand of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. Ufanai, and as we look into the future ahead, lo yeirah, we can't see them. We don't know where we're going. And that was true of the events, of the day of the first Suda of Achashverosh, Esther and Haman. The perception was for Klal Yisrael of absolute disaster, catastrophe. And the reality was that was the Yeshua that they were looking at. They were looking at the Yeshua with no sense that it was the Yeshua. And that is the Yisrael of Klal Yisrael and Golos. We face realities which are harsh and difficult. And we don't see that within those realities lie the very seeds of our Atzala, of our Atzlach. And Klal Yisrael, we survive. We don't even understand ourselves how we necessarily survive in the ghosts. Each set of problems that comes seems overwhelming and daunting. And yet, come out the other side with the one. And that the Yisoid that we celebrate in the Megillah. That in the Golos, while we're out Kati Avdi Achashverosh Hashanah, we weren't Zeichet to the Yeshua yet. But the hand of the Rabbeinu Shel Olam sustained us in ways that we cannot conceivably anticipate. So we gather in our door. Even in times when there were dark clouds on the horizon. But we need to see beyond them. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam is ever present. We cannot always understand what direction the Rebbeinu Shel Olam wants to go. Sometimes we see. Sometimes we will never see. And I always tell my Talmidim that my personal perspective on this is the life of my paternal grandfather, Rav Shalom. He was nifter many years before I was born. My paternal grandfather was born in 1866. You can make a little chesed how old he would be if you were alive today. He died at the age of 69 in 1935, more than 70 years ago. My paternal grandfather was a builder chassid. And I did not, through most of my life, I did not really comprehend his life. He came to this country in 1913. He was 47 years old. And here he got married and he had children, three children. One of them died in childhood of scarlet fever. And he had two children. And I wondered exactly what the story of his life was. How did a Hasidish Jew wind up at the age of 47 getting married and having his children? And I don't know, it's something I guess I never crossed my mind to ask my father, Rav Shalom. But one of my children had to do a report about the family for school. While I was well here in Kew Garden Hills. So I had at that time an elderly aunt, Aleha Shalom, my father's sister, older sister. So I told myself, listen, call her up and ask her. You want to know about the family? I can't tell you, you know. My grandfather died long before I was born. So she tells my son the following, that my grandfather was an almond. He was married in Europe, but he was an almond. He was a widower, and he had no children from his first marriage. My grandfather was also drafted into the Tsar's army, and he served. There was a war between Turkey and Russia in 1895. And he was a soldier in that war, I think, for 3 years in the Tsar's army. Now, both of these became very significant factors in his life. In 1913, because of the fact that he had been in the army and he knew many military people from the years he was in the army, he was quite certain that war was imminent in Europe. The military establishment was convinced of that. And he, for the people that he knew in the military, he shared their perspective. And he also correctly predicted that if he stayed, if war came to Europe, he'd be called back into the Tsar's army again, which is exactly what happened. The people till the age of 50 were called up to the Tsar's army in the First World War. And he decided one stint in the Tsar's army was enough for him. He had no intention of serving a second time in the Tsar's army. Now, he was also an almond, so he had nothing. He didn't have a wife and children that he had to worry about. So one fine day he just left and he traveled straight south through Galicia, went to Italy, and from Italy he sailed and he arrived in the United States in 1913. He lived here until 1935. An atmosphere which was certainly quite hostile to a Hasidic Jew. And he managed to be in a living and have his own business. And he didn't, you know, to avoid problems. He didn't have problems, you know, with Chilul Shabbos. He worked for himself. And in 1935 he died. So if I would have asked him at that point that he left this world, what's the story of his life, he would tell you it was a very strange life. Circumstances forced him, you know, to run away from Europe. He separated from his family to live in a very strange country and to die in this country by himself. That's what he would have made of his own life. I have a different perspective. My grandfather came from a town in Poland where in the Holocaust there were very, very few survivors. Very, very few. I have one distant relative who lived in South Africa who was a survivor. He never wanted to talk about it because there were very, very few survivors from that to me. So I realized the hashgach of the Rebbeinu Shalom. He created circumstances in my grandfather's life where he drove him out of Europe. Al Karcha. Not because he wanted to leave, but he felt he had no choice. But because of that, he has family that survived until today. So a person lives with a perspective where we don't understand what the Rebbeinu Shalom wants, where we're headed, what we're doing. Sometimes in life we understand it, and sometimes we don't get to see how the movie ends, what the punchline of the story is. But that's the emunah that we learn from Purim, that we should not be overwhelmed by events. As dark as they may be, the reality of them may be far different than what we see. I want to start with the halacha, which is quite important this year. And that is, there's a Mishnah in Megillah, in the Chofam and Aleph, which says the following. There are all the mitzvahs, which are nogeya, in the daytime, which are relevant to daytime. So one is supposed to do them in between sunrise and sunset, let's put it in our terms, between Neitzacham and Shkia Sacham. And however, if we did them from Amra Shachar and on, from daybreak and on, we Yaitzim. What's the reason for this Mishnah? The reason for this Mishnah is that sunrise is something which is very apparent. Everyone can know when the sun rises. You look outside, you see the sun. Amra Shachar is much more difficult to calculate. So they were concerned that a person might miscalculate and do the mitzvah while it's still the night time. So the Chatzchila, they made this man from mitzvah Tayyim from the Itzacham. And Shasat Chak, they made the Yoytzeh from Amra Shachar. One did it from Amra Shachar, but the Yevid, one's Yoytzeh, or Shasat Chak, the Chatzchila wants to do them after Amra Shachar. And this applies, it certainly applies to Megillah as well. So, certainly the primary time to hear the Megillah is after the Itzacham. But the reason it becomes important is this Motzei Shabbos was starting the Eretz Yisrael time. So the Nate on Purim is going to be at 7:15 in the morning. Right? The first minyan is going to read the Megillah about 6:30 in the morning. By the time 7:15 comes, they're going to finish. So if one has the opportunity to go to the second minyan on that day, one should certainly avail himself of the opportunity of going to the second minyan. The Chofetz Chaim writes, even if there's Eines Ketzas, if one has some difficulty with going after Beit HaChama, one should let a hear the Megillah before Beit HaChama. But the Chatzchila, one should hear the Megillah after Beit HaChama. So that is a halacha which has become relevant in this particular year, which is not normally relevant. Now, what's interesting is when it comes to tefillah, what's the din? And here there's a very interesting debate in the Achrayim. The Mishnah does not mention tefillah. It mentions many mitzvahs. But mitzvah tefillah is not mentioned in this Mishnah as an example, which would seem to be the quintessential example. That's the mitzvah that comes every day at Neitz HaChama. That one should do it at Neitz HaChama, not before. So why is this? So here we have a debate among the Achrayim. There are some that say that tefillah is the same as any other mitzvah shabiyim, and therefore it should be done dafka after Eitz HaChama. On the other hand, there are those that say that the Mishnah has omitted the statement because of the fact that the zman, the only zman tefillah lechatchila is basikin. Any other zman other than basikin is b'diavad. And whether that is precedes the Eitz HaChama or follows the Eitz HaChama is not particularly relevant. All equally with the other. There are many Achroinim. I mean, the Pri Yitzchak, it's the Petterburg and his Tshuva, Siman Beis, pursues this great length. He's probably the greatest exposition of this position. I believe that Rav Moshe Zatzal also adopted this position based on the Diuk and the Mishnah in Megillah. I don't know if his exposition, though, it's what I recall. I don't believe his exposition is nearly as lengthy is the Pri Yitzchak's, in the consideration of all the facets of the sugya and what it's in print. So here by tefillah we have a machlekes about it. And certainly for the sake of tefillah with tzibur, the minhag has certainly been that Klal Yisrael is noyig l'kula. You know, that we certainly, for the sake of tefillah with tzibur, we certainly daven before the nates, rather than not, no worry about davening b'yechidus after the nates. So perhaps the minhagists have adopted the more lenient of the two positions in the Achrayim. So this is a halacha which is very relevant. Now, on the other side, there's also another halacha that becomes relevant, and that is the Tzeisek HaChovim is unusually late this year. And I don't recall it, you know, it was,
you know.
Also, but yeah, but Purim was a little later last year. Yeah, it was probably later last year. This is because of the new time for starting the in throughout. Historically, there was only one year that it was daylight savings time. This time of the year, it was in the oil crisis in 1974. After that period, that winter, but other than that, it hasn't taken place until this now new restructuring of daylight savings time. So what happens is that this man for the Megillah is getting later and later. Now, the Shkiyas HaChama on Purim, the night of Purim, let's just take a look. Okay, it was Monday the 8th, the Shkiyah is at 6:56, it's 4 minutes to 7. On the night of Purim, on Leil Purim. So, even if one took the most liberal shita, basically, for Tzeisek HaChovim, that one should not read the Megillah until about 7:38 at the earliest. you wanted to take the most liberal shita, you know, you could take more chumradik shitas, which we do in the basic Knesset, we're a little bit later than that, but another 8 minutes after that is a minimum, practically longer than that. So the problem is with it being so late that there are people that have in fact a shayla on the table, that someone is traveling to Eretz Yisrael and they're leaving on the night of Purim, on Monday night they have to go to Eretz Yisrael. So they're going to arrive in Eretz Yisrael sometime Monday, Tuesday afternoon. So what are they going to do about the Megillah? Yeah, now, if they, and especially
they
in Prophet.
They don't change it. They're still on, they don't change daylight savings. For them, the day is shorter.
Yeah. So besides forgetting the daytime reading, maybe they'll make the daytime reading. That is a little I could do about it. Maybe there'll be people, somebody on the plane to read it. I have no idea. But for the nighttime reading, that's the problem I'm dealing with.
You're going to read it before you leave.
No, they don't. They're going to have to be in the airport. They have to be in the airport already. They're going to have to go through security before the time to read it. So the earliest time to read is going to be about, I said 6:57:38 about. They're gonna long be gone through security by that time.
Is the plane leaving?
I don't know exactly. I don't know. This person happens to be as a woman, so she really doesn't even have the ability to take a Megill and read it for herself, you know. So
okay, well, wasn't it just a fact that women can also?
Good. We'll see if your wife knows how to read the Megill, you know. I didn't say she can't. She's not allowed to read for herself. Just, she's a grandmother. In her generation, they didn't think about such things, you know. A nice Jewish lady went to shul in the night of Purim and heard them read the Megillah and went home, you know. So, there's a very interesting halacha. It comes in the Trumas Adeshin. Trumas Adeshin Paskin, that just as we have in the halacha, Plaga Mincha, we could often marav early, Kiddush early, that we could do Kriyas HaMegillah on the early side, from Plaga Mincha on if necessary. Yeah. Now, this is a very controversial psak. The Prichod is very vociferously disagreed with it. The Vildegoin disagreed with it. Why? Because the Gemara from Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says that a person has to read the Megillah b'laylo shalishanoisa b'yeit. And the pasuk of Laila, the Gemara quotes the pasuk of Laila v'lodom di'ali, that it was night, and the Rebbeinu Shalom was not silent in the night. In the night of Golus, the Rebbeinu Shalom wasn't silent, but he spilled on the pasuk of Laila v'lodom di'ali. So Laila, it's hard to call it Laila. It may be after Plaga Mincha, certain mitzvahs one could do at that point, but to actually call it Laila at that point, that's stretching things pretty far. So it's rather interesting that the Aruch HaShulchan writes that he is in agreement with the Shitas HaGro, that really he doesn't see the basis to do it before, despite the fact that there are more sites. And he says, I've never in my life seen such a thing. That anyone ever read the Megillah before Teisa Kochav, never saw such a thing. The Yechavet Chaim still remains, is willing to sign off that if there's a real, you know, Chayla, something, a real Shasat Chak, for a person, that a person that needs to read it early, a person could read it after Plaga Mincha. So this is it's a problematic psak, because there are major achronim who disagree with it. But yet, it may for some people remain as the only avenue for them to be able to read to the Megillah.
Doesn't the Mishnah say that you could read it on the 13th?
Oh, you're not, that's all of these, first of all, those days that we can read it, the Gemara says in the Zman of the Golus, they no longer apply. The Gemara says, it brings a mind of Rabbi Yehuda, that it's only Zman Shiso Shuyin Alad Moson, and everything is, life is in an orderly fashion, and we had all of these Yud Aleph, Yud Beis, Yud Gimel, etc., as outlined in the first mission of the Megillah. But under those circumstances, the Zman of the Golus, they no longer apply, all of those Zman of above. Yeah, there is nominally a din that a person that mefarish vayitzi b'shayora is after Rosh Chodesh Adar, there's some Indian that he should read a Megillah, but it's not actually yaitzi with that. That seems more as like an Indian of some zeicha to the mitzvah, since he won't actually be able to read on Purim. Yeah.
How is she going to find someone to read for her?
Her family will go with her, and they'll sit with her in the airport right before she goes through the security.
But she has a shot from Kach. The problem is that
So they'll have to hear again later.
But if she can eat, the person's reading can make the brachos.
So I told them that certainly, my shayla, I told them certainly not to make the brachos. I'm not even convinced that she should necessarily make the brachos either, because it's controversial. Maybe she should hear the lady without the brachos that I'm still trying to sort out. But that the person that reads the Megillah before Netzachama, let's say before Netzachama, there's also the Chatchila, if he could, should hear, if he doesn't have a Shasat Chak, he should hear it again later. If I don't need to hear it at that hour, I have a Talmud that has to read it at first minyan. So I told him he should hear the Megillah again sometime during the day. So he has to read it near the end of the day for some women. So he wants to be yaitzi then. So then he had a new shayla. But he's not supposed to eat before he hears the Megillah. So what should he do? So he asked, he's very tight with his father Shalom. So he asked his father Shalom. But the Rav told him, in terms of eating, it could be same mechan the Megillah that he heard before they took Chama in the morning. So he told me, Pesach, I said, I agree with his father Shalom. So he answered, you will. He answered, good Pesach. But this is some of the circumstances that all can arise, you know, due to the skewed clock that we have in this particular year. One of the abiding mysteries, which I attempted to unravel, and I come back to, and little by little it's getting a little clearer to me. In Siman Tov Resh Tzadik Hei, we have a halacha that we're supposed to recite Al Anisim in the Birchas Hamazon of Purim. Now, what happens if one benched after Sudas Purim and one forgot to recite the Al Anisim? Do we have to bench again or not? And it happens to be rather interestingly that there is a machlokes achrayna about it. Some say yes and some say no. The Chofetz Chaim gives the psak of Sofet Brochus Lahokal, the Sofet not to, which is also interesting in its own regard. Why normally in Sofet you should have to venture again because it's in the race. But that's in its own chiddush. But what is the machlokes about? Now, normally we have the following. Let's trace the halachas, the known halachas. On Shabbos, the dinner is if one omitted ritzei, that one has to bench again. Why? Because it's a chiyuv to have a suit on Shabbos. On Rosh Chodesh, on the other hand, if I fail to say Yalu v'yavu and Birchas Hamazon, I don't have to repeat the benching because there's no chiyuv suda. So it seems to follow, whenever there's a chiyuv suda, then I'm perforce, the halacha puts me in the situation that I have to bench, and therefore I have to bench appropriately. But, so, if it doesn't impose upon me this din, so then I shouldn't have to, then I wouldn't have to bench again. Now, among the Achronim, it does not see any, it seems in this general agreement that the Chiyuv Suda on Tisha B'Av should include washing. That seems to be, on Purim. Purim should include washing. That seems to be in all parties in this debate. It certainly wasn't the only svar of why you wouldn't have to bench again. So what exactly is the issue? So I tried to unravel this. And I conclude with the following cheshbon. What happens by davening on Purim? We certainly have to daven. And what happens if we fail to say Yal Anisim? Do we have to daven again? So we paskin that you don't. It's interesting that Tosfos in Megillah says that if one failed to say Yal Anisim on either Hanukkah or Purim, one has to daven again. One omitted the Al Anisim. But we do not believe in Tosis. I believe in the Al Anisim also. Tosis held one had a daven again. Tosis talks about in Zachreino and all of these things. I believe Tosis sheet is an Al Anisim. We had a daven again. We don't pass it this way. If they have to daven again. So the Shaila is, so why is it? I certainly have to daven on Purim, so why don't I have to daven again? I want to know what the answer to that question is. Now, I have two possible answers to that question. And depending which answer you take, we'll arrive at a halacha which is relevant by Birchas Hamazon. One halacha may be, very simply, that do we daven on Purim? We daven on Purim because it's Purim, or we daven on Purim because it's Tuesday morning? It's the regular weekday davening, right? It's Shabbos we daven a yontiv. It's a Shabbos davening. It's yontiv. Shabbos and yontiv itself is a mechayev in the tefillah. The Purim has nothing to do with the chiyah tefillah. It happens to be it's Purim, but so mevela we could say the following: the Shmon Esrei is not a Purim Shmon Esrei. It's a weekday Shmon Esrei which happens to be on Purim. Benching though is a Purim dikedin because it comes from the Suda, so I should have to in that regard bench again. Now, what would be the other side? That why I shouldn't have to bench again? Not so obvious. This cheshbon would seem to be quite a compelling cheshbon. The answer is that we started a step too late in our analysis. We have to go a step earlier than we've gone yet. And that is, and this is, we'll put it in brisket terms, is that we first have to determine if this is a day where the halacha insists that it be, that the tefillah include the yom, the mention of the yom, the significance of the yom. That's din number one. If there is a din that I have to include in various elements of tefillah today, the inyan hayom, the ma'ina ma'ira, what the day is about, then I can start asking myself where I have to put these elements. So I could say, Purim is a day which obligates me to mention the significance of the day. So then I can ask myself, well, where? Well, Tefillah is a place that we should mention the day. Pichas HaMozen is a place where we should mention the day. Fine. On the other hand, if Purim is not a day, if the day is not a day where I have to mention the significance of the day, then I don't get to the second question if I'm a chiyuv or not a chiyuv. If we're saying those things which are a chiyuv on this particular day, if it's a day where I have to do it, so therefore it's self-understood. Since there's an inyan of benching, for example, on Shabbos, to mention Shabbos, to mention the day, and Shabbos is a day that I have to mention, and then I'm obligated to have this suda, but the first two sudas of Shabbos, not by Shabbos, is I had to wash, so I have to recite the day. Whereas Shalashuddas, where I could have been yaitu with the Eved without washing. So I don't have an obligation to recite. Nothing obligated me, so there's no obligation to mention the day either. But I first have to determine, before I ask myself if I'm so obligated, if it's a day which in the first place would obligate me to mention its significance. So I believe that the other answer to the first question is why we don't go back again by davening. Because Purim is not a day which obligates me to mention Ma'ana Ma'ara. Well, it's nice that we put it in, but that's all. It is not obligatory in Tefillah in the first place. And consequently, when we come to benching, it's also not. It's not an obligatory aspect of Tefillah. So even I may be obligated to bench, but there's no obligation to mention the Ma'ana Ma'ara. Now that could be, very simply stated, that all the things that we mention in Tefillah, that we have to mention, all the right sort of things. Rice in the Kadesh. Right. Shabbos, Yontif, Rosh Chodesh. Those all are Rosh Chodesh. Those are the rice in the Kadesh. There are boron happenings, they never created the chiv of being masculine between them. The tefillah has to include where I'm coming from today. Now, Mamela, that's why it's equally true on Chanukah. I omitted the Al Nisim, I don't have to go back. So we have two possibilities of why we don't mention we don't have to go back by Tefillah. So again, if it's the first one, because the Tefillah is considered a Tefillah Shel Chayav, but the Birchas HaMozon, which I'm obligated by Dinei Purim to get myself into, because Dinei Purim say that I have to wash, and therefore, it's obligatory because of the din of Purim. So then now the Al Nisim is Likuva. If, though, I take the latter stance, that the mention of the day is not significant by those midrabanan events, such as Chanukah or Purim, then it's irrelevant if, because it is day, I have to bench, daven, or anything else. But there's no such obligation. It would come out almost paradoxical. In other words, if hypothetically the tefillah would be viewed as a Purim Dikei tefillah, I still wouldn't have to mention Purim. So that, I believe, is the yesod of this machlokes. Yeah.
According to the first approach, then, what defines the Seudah? Because you could have breakfast, you could have lunch, and then you have your main Seudah.
So it could very well be
only one.
It could very well be that once you washed once during the day, and you said the Alav Nisim, you would not have to. It would not be different than Shalosh Seudah. Even though your intention is to be yaked to the main Seudah later on. You know, I'm always...
The Nafkamish would mean that you'd only have to repeat if you forgot breakfast, but not if you forgot...
Well, if you forgot breakfast, maybe you wouldn't have to, because you could say, I'll be yaitzi later on. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
I don't dafka have to have this Seudah. Uh-huh. I could have one Seudah during the day. It's not... So I'm not sure. But, you know, even according to that sheet, there could be I could rely upon later on.
Right.
But I personally believe that if you bench, that's what I believe, you're right, that if you were yaitzi earlier in the day, then you don't have to, at the main Seudah Purim, you would not have to recite the benching, even according to the other sheet. That's what I believe to be the case. Now, that's also just maybe a, it's hard to know, maybe a wise idea. I mean, if one's concerned for whatever reason that one may start the Purim Seudah very late, is to wash earlier in the day and be yaitzi at least, you know, it's something. And worry later about, you know, eating the main Seudah Purim. So this is the Indian of benching at Seudah Purim, which is a very fascinating subject. The lumdus is very, very fascinating. Now, Tainus Esther is a very strange happening. Why do I say it's strange? Because we have no reference in the Shas to, or in the Medrash to its existence. The Rishonim made a discovery that on the Jewish calendar, the day before Purim, people fast. But we don't have any direct source which tells us why that might be the case. In all the literature, there is only one reference at the beginning of Masechta Megillah to the 13th of Adar. And what that means exactly. What is Yud Gimel Zman Kehila Lakoli? Some say it would mean that they came together to be mispalded. That was the day they fought the war. That was the Kehila Lakoli. They actually fought the war. And there were varied interpretations. When the Gemara says that it's self-evident that one could read the Megillah in the smaller cities, could use Gimel Zman Kehila Lakoli, there are varied interpretations of the Rishayim. But, so that's the only mention that we find of Yud Gimel. So what is the significance of this day? And we have varied explanations. They're all over the map. There are those that would say that this is, even though one was Esther's Tainus, Yudala Tetzvav Tezayin Nisan. So hers was a 3-day fast in Nisan. And yet we make the Zeicha for it in Adam, that's one view. There, the Kolbo is a very interesting approach. Kolbo says that at the, near the end of the Megillah, it says that what do they include? Divrei Hatzimlis Mizakosim. The fast, Mizakosim, and the Tfilis. This was also included in the Megillah. So he says, in effect, that Purim is really a celebration of both steps of the process. The steps that we took to merit Yeshua and the celebration of Yeshua. But it is really a celebration of both. Now, Achazal understood, as I often say, that we could have Purim in the Jewish calendar, or we could have Yom Kippur in the Jewish calendar. But one thing one dare not try is to have both of those on one day. That you can't have. And therefore, they took the two elements of Purim, which really took place on two different days. One on the day, one was the day they went to battle. That was apparently the Yom Tzayim, Tainus, and Yud Gimel. And Yudalad was the day of the Yeshua. So on the day that they fasted, or Divrei HaTzaymus of Zakosa, we engage in the same thing. We emphasize the Tefillah and the Tanis. On Yudalad, where they celebrated the triumph, we celebrate the triumph. So really, it's a celebration of the entire process which brought about how Purim came about and the celebration of its triumph as well. That's, so he ties it back to Kol Bo'ol all the way actually to the din of the Megillah itself. It's rooted within the Pesukim in the Megillah. What we do. The Ravid looks like he must have lived in Eretz Yisrael and in Yerushalayim at some time, even though I think he didn't, but it looks like he understood it very well. You know, the Ravid wins the prize for creativity. Ad kedei kach, when I told it once to Shnei Alayman, is so astounded by the idea that he thought maybe it's not even true that the Ravid ever wrote such a thing. So there's many shyness. It's in the Sefer Eshkol. That's what a Ravid writes it. So he went to the edition of the Sefer Eshkol, which he believes is the authentic edition, which, you know, and he checked it there and it came back to me. It's in there too. So he believes it. So what does the Ravid say? The Ravid says that they were afraid that people would forget to read the Megillah on the night of Purim. So just as, you know, we don't eat before Marv on any night, so we don't eat before the Megillah, so we fast the whole day. After I saw this Ravid, I wondered. I mean, listen, we don't fast when this month comes, yeah, half an hour before, but to fast the whole day? What's the pshat? Number one. Number two, I mean, there would seem that the possibility of forgetting the Megillah in one regard would seem a little bit more far-fetched than to forget Kriya Shema. As the Gemara says in general, that Trei Koli Lo Mishtamoi, there are two different voices at once you don't hear. But if it's Chavuv, you do hear. The Megillah is certainly Chavuv. It certainly is an excitement. Purim is high, has a high profile. So why was he so concerned that we're going to forget to read the Megillah? So then I came one, finally it struck me what the Ravid wanted. The Ravid said, listen, what would happen if Erev Purim were a regular day? Listen, let's just go visit what happens in Yerushalayim when Yud-Al Adar. By the time the Esther was finished already, right? Purim's tomorrow, so what's Yud-Al Adar? So you dial it door, you start already out of the yoga. You can wait for Tesla, you know. Listen, you certainly at least, at the very least, you got to celebrate with the rest of Klal Yisrael. So I think the Ravid was concerned, I believe, that we start the Purim celebration, we wouldn't wait till the night. We want to wait till the night of your dollar. I mean, this is such a good thing. We should start by the end, you know. The Kolamavar is a Meshubach, you know. So by the time the night of Purim would come, I mean, the guy would be on the other side of Adal Yoda already, you know. That's why he would forget the Megillah. I mean, I saw fellas many, many years ago who on the night of Purim, they were Mekayim Adal Yoda. And
Cheat of Adal Yoda. Which Cheat of Adal Yoda?
All the days. The Eitel L'Chola days. And then they went to sleep.
I think he also had Adal Yoda the day before.
The daytime. They made sure that in the daytime it was still Adal Yoda. And some of these guys, they didn't know anything that happened between 11 and 12 o'clock in the night of Purim and Motzei Purim. They had no idea of anything that took place. So I think that was the Ravid's concern. How are you going to forget? You'll forget. You'll be on the Adal Yoda land. So I think that's what the Ravid wanted. So Tainus Esther is interesting. I mean, according to the Ravid, it shouldn't even be called Tainus Esther, for that matter. Some say it's associated with the day that they went to the war, they used to fast. This should have a schus. So it stems from the Gimel Zman Kehilah Akoyli, which is also not consistent with calling it Tainus Esther. This is not reminiscent of the fast of Esther that she called. It's reminiscent of what happened the next year when they went into battle, that they fasted for a schus. So even if it shouldn't be called Tainus Esther, it's a matter which is debatable. I just wanted to touch briefly upon one final subject, and that is question that the Ran asks at the beginning of Masechta Megillah, I believe the Ramban raised it as well, that why is it that Purim is the only Chag that we have Klal Yisrael is divided. We celebrate two different days. Had an uncle, Olav HaShalom, when he was one of the Talmidim that was the founding Talmidim of Yeshiva Chavetz Chaim. Rav David Leibowitz, if a Tzadik Levorach left Torah Vidas in 1933, he went to Wisdom, and they started Chavetz Chaim. And he's one of the first Mesmochim of Yeshiva. So he said that they had to finish high school. They were 12th graders. So when Williamsburg, they had Eastern District High School. So they went to Eastern District High School at night to finish, you know, to get the diplomas. So some of the chevra decided one week, here's the guys that are not showing up to class. So they came back next week. And the teacher asked them, and he says, I don't get this. So why were you? So they said, no, there was a Jewish festival last week. You couldn't come. So, okay. And all of a sudden he stops. He says, wait a second. He says, I don't get this. But half the guys were all here. What's going on here? You know? So one of them was a real chevron. So he says, now I have to tell you, he says, in the Jewish community, in different communities, this is celebrated at different times. He says, in their community, they celebrated it last week. We celebrate it next week. So the question is, what happened here? Every yontif we have different, every shaver has yontif on a different day. Yontif is yontif for all the Klal Yisrael. So why in the world did they make yontif on two different days? On most of the Klal Yisrael are Yudala, Yerushalayim, and a few other places on Tesfot. For what reason? It's atypical. Every yontif is one yontif for all the Klal Yisrael. They have tasted and divide yontif into different days. It's very puzzling. One answer to this question is that the experience of the Yom Tov was different for the different people. And therefore, it had to be celebrated differently. Who was most in danger? Well, most in danger was not even the people in the open cities, because they had the least possibility of the Oriya process. They had the least possibility of defending themselves. If you lived... What did they do when they made settlements outside of the usual line? They used like a Meir Shor. They built it that there were no doors to the houses on the street. All the doors were internal. If you look at Meir Shor, there was all walls on the outside. And a few places where there were gates. Until some place probably in the late 19th, early 20th century, they used to lock the gates at night. Yeah, because that way there were only a few ways. Those were only a few ways to get in. So all they had to do for security was to just bar those few places, and they were safe. But there was no way to reach. It's all on the street. It's all walls. There's not a single door of a house that's on the street. If you look the way Meir Shalom was constructed, there are no doors.
Is that where I got the name from?
Maybe. I don't know. But there were no doors. Well, and that was very typical, because for security, that's what you did. So if you build a wall around yourself, you're safe. If you're open to the street, warrior prophets, so you say them could come when they want. So they had a different threat than the people in the walled cities. The walled cities have a different issue. It was easier in some regard, at least to keep outsiders away from you. Even though maybe they had internal enemies too, but outside enemies, that's one view, were easier to keep away than in the open cities, where the marauders could just come and do whatever they wanted. So since the Sakona was different, therefore, they celebrated in different days because they faced a different situation. They celebrated a different type of victory. But it's a very unique celebration in Jewish history. The fact, the only one that we have, which is bifurcated, the different parts of Klal Yisrael celebrate at different times.
Yeah. Didn't the people in Shushan need an extra day to kill their enemies?
That was. Part of it in Shushan itself, that there was obviously the Shushan was the seat of the bureaucracy. So they felt that Haman people were really overly overrepresented in the seat of the bureaucracy with his power and all the patronage that he had. He obviously had a huge amount of his people in Shushan itself. So that's apparently why the Jews felt the necessity of having another day to uproot them. So, you know, that touches part of the problem of this pshat is ideal, but it's a pshat to discuss because of the fact that there were not only external enemies, but there were internal enemies as well. In other words, you didn't need enemies dafka to come from outside the city in which you live. They had enemies within every place that they lived. So that's also part of the issue there. But as I say, this is the most unique of Jewish celebrations, the fact that it's a bifurcated celebration. Okay, I believe it's time for now.
Ironically, the Jewish things, because they were not bifurcated.